that makes them very rare people. the guys who are on 24 and 78 gigahertz, you go to the microwave reflector and you see lots of information flowing back and forth right now about guys assembling equipment for 78 gigahertz ham band. The 10 gigahertz ham band that I was on quite actively starting in the year roughly 2000. Let me drop it. That's the 72nd harmonic of 144 megs. Guys who get up to 2 meters, 144 megs, you think you're on a high frequency. You multiply that frequency by, I think it's 72, and you're at 10 gigs. And 10.368 is the popular frequency because it's an exact harmonic of 144. Every one of us can set our synthesizer to 144.0. And if you plug that signal into a mixer, you will hear the 72nd harmonic at 10.368. So it becomes a frequency marker, as well as being a an agreed-upon frequency for everyone to meet. The 10-gig ham band starts at 10.0 and goes to 10.5. The 10-gig ham band is 500 megahertz wide. Can you imagine what you can do with that much bandwidth if you want to send very high-speed data, television, or whatever? Let me drop it. So, the guys will occasionally have some fun on that band, saying, this is KQRIW calling CQ 10 gigahertz and carefully tuning the band. What does that mean? Are you going to tune all 500 megahertz with a 10 kilohertz wide receiver, 10 kilohertz at a time, 500 megs? Of course not. As I said, the agreed-upon gentleman's agreement is 10.368. It's the calling frequency. 10.368, 100, I guess, is the calling frequency. And below that is the CW callers. And most of the 10-gig beacons are set up at 10.368. 10,368 megs, and add another 300 KC to that is roughly where the beacons are. And so those beacons are fun to listen to. Okay, you guys have heard the first section, so to speak, of the space report. As I look through this article a little bit further, Paul, the original guy who was the principal investigator of the OSIRIS-REx looks like it was Michael J. Drake. I wonder if that's the same guy who invented the Drake equation way back in the early 60s. The Drake equation, let me drop it.
That was Frank Drake.
You're right. Okay, so Mike, let me drop it. I should have remembered that. So that was Frank Drake, and this is Michael J. Drake, and maybe he's not related. This article is written by Daniel Lauretta, L-A-U-R-E-T-T-A, Lauretta. So I think he became the new principal investigator after Michael J. Drake passed away. Is that true? That's not about right, Paul?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, I just heard his name a couple times since the program started, since it was advertised a lot that they were going to be doing this. By the way, I just want to say that on the 14th, supposed to be the 14th of this month, you should be able to, if you can get the National Geographic Channel 162, in my case, because I have an Optimum, you could watch the six-part series, the beginning of the six-part series called Mars. I don't know how good it is. It looks like it's good from what I read, but you never know. I hope it's technical enough, for the guys that like this stuff. But we'll see. I'll definitely watch it. Now, I don't know what time it's going to be on, so you have to check the local schedule for that. Back to you.
I think somebody mailed you and me, and maybe John, an email saying that there is a YouTube video that gives you a taste of one of those six sections of that National Geographic program on Mars. Does that sound right? Did you get a copy of that email, Paul? KQRIW?
I did get a copy of that, and I answered it, because I won't look at anything until I watch the show, and then after that, I'll look at all the email and advertisements that they have for it. But yeah, I did see a website, an actual website that you can go to, and you can click on different things, and they'll give you previews, and I think there's one thing where you can actually watch it and sit on, you know, watch it on a computer. I'm not gonna sit, you know, for 2 hours and watch this thing on a tablet, so that's not enjoyable. You can do that with those kinds of things back in.
Now, the advertisement for the Mars National Geographic program that you've read, what do we know about that program? Is it going to, obviously, it's going to tell us something about the past history of man's enthusiasm for Mars, and where I think it was Mr. Schiaparelli used to think that he was seeing canals on Mars way back in roughly 1900. When we first had a big enough telescope to start looking at Mars, he thought he saw what's called man-made structures on Mars. It turns out he was misinterpreting what he was seeing. Let me drop. So, it's a prominent planet. It's easy to see. It's got a distinctive color. We used to think it must be filled with Martians. We used to think Venus was filled with Venusians. And when we first had a Mariner spacecraft fly by Mars, take a picture, and you saw a landscape that's filled with craters, you knew right away that there wasn't much air there, and the chances of higher intelligence life being there was very, very low. So I presume an awful lot of these six installments of National Geographic are going to be specializing on the hardware that's being developed and how we intend to use it and how we intend to send people there with a habitat and food on a one-way mission. Did the tease of the six programs that you've read so far, did it say something along those lines? Did it give you a hint as to what you're going to see, Paul? WS2N, PQIW.
It looks like it's going to be a regular movie with actors, you know, probably getting into a rocket and getting there somehow. It looks like that type of thing. Now, there's a lot of consultants that were involved. Mary Roach from the book Packing for Mars. You've got Ann Durant, the wife of Carl Sagan, or the widow of Carl Sagan. She was always involved with his programs anyway, so she was consulted. She was consulted for Cosmos series when they did the remake of that. Neil deGrasse Tyson got his comments. I'm going to be involved. And the guy that runs he's out of Virginia. He runs the company that makes arrangements to send private tourists to space. You know, right now it's through the Russian Soyuz program, but that hasn't been done in quite a while. They got him on. I think he's originally from Queens. Got his name. These people, I don't know if they're going to be interviewed or if they were just consultants for this. I don't know yet. Back to you.
Now, what you guys have heard so far in Space Report, tonight's Space Report, which is report number 226, do you have any questions on what you've heard or on anything else on the space subject? Give us your call letters right now, K2LIW.
I guess not. You have a GOES satellite going up within about a week or so, too. That should be good.
The GOES satellite, I think that's a whole series of satellites called GOES. Give us a few words on that one, Paul. And I presume that launch is not visible from Long Island. Is that true?
Oh, that's true. And the GOES, it's a weather satellite. You know, right now we have pictures coming back, say, for hurricanes. And, you know, sometimes they're 6 hours or sometimes even 12 or 24 hours old. Where this new one, you'll be able to process pictures, you know, one pitch every 30 seconds or something like that. So that should be good. This is the first of four new ones. It's a couple of billion-dollar program that NOAA has going up. With the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is sending this thing up. And they, you know, we have an east and west one up there now, and then there's one backup. But these new ones are going to replace it, so it's called the GOES R, and then there'll be another one, another GOES S and T, and that'll be going up within the next probably 5 years or so. So it should make watching the weather a little bit better. The pictures are supposed to be a heck of a lot better. In fact, the one satellite that I mentioned earlier that Japan sets up, they have the same type of camera on their geosynchronous satellite, you know, on their end. So that goes off. I'll have to look up. I think it's going up about a week or two from California, from Florida on an Atlas rocket. We dropped it. So that should be going, you know, when they say they're going to go, they're going to go. Atlas is very reliable unless there's a weather problem. Talking about Atlas for a second, and restocking the International Space Station. Orbital Science is the company that launched the rocket that we could see from Long Island that you just talked about. Orbital Science became Orbital ATK. That's their new name. ATK got involved with them. And they launched the Antares rocket a couple of weeks ago with the Cygnus cargo vehicle on top to the International Space Station. Now NASA is so worried about SpaceX not being able to fulfill their agreement for a while of sending cargo. Orbital ATK decided to also contract another flight with Atlas down in Florida. They're going to send one of their Cygnus spacecraft and put it on top. They've done this twice. They did it last year, December and March. First of December and then this year, March. They used the Atlas rocket twice to send the Cygnus spacecraft up to the space station. And the reason they like to do that, even so, this new Antares rocket is more powerful than the old one. It's nowhere near as powerful as the Atlas. So last time, this one that we could see from Long Island had 5,000 pounds worth, a little over 5,000 pounds worth of cargo. Atlas could deliver around 7,300 pounds. And they need as much stuff up at that space station, according to NASA, as possible. So Atlas is very reliable. But to go back to the GOES satellite, that's coming up probably within a week or two. Back to you.
Would you be able to make a rough estimate, Paul, of the number of pounds of consumables that are delivered as cargo to the International Space Station per year? Is there a rough way we can make a rough guess as to how many pounds of consumables, material, is brought up to the International Space Station per year? I wonder if the ISS people have ever published anything like that, or with all the data you've got, you may be able to make a rough guess. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, by the way, GOES is going up November 16th of this month. So wrote it down here somewhere, and I found it 442, so 4:42 p.m. How many pounds? Well, it's interesting. I never figured it out that way, but we could do that real quick. But it's interesting to see the first contract, the first cargo contract that Orbital ATK has with these Cygnus spacecraft that are going up. Their first contract was for 8 spacecraft to go to the space station, 8 over a series of years. And their total deal for NASA was 63,000 pounds. So that's fresh in my mind because I read that the other day. 63,000 pounds total, and it was almost a $2 billion contract. Now, since then, they've got another contract. You know, they're adding, you could add maybe another 10 flights on top of that for the next cargo missions, which haven't even happened yet. But gives you an idea, 63,000 pounds at almost $2 billion, not quite, but let's call it $2 billion for round numbers. I think it was 1.8. Let's see, progress goes up four times a year, so that's, you did the math real quick, you're good at that, Dick. You got 5,000 pounds each, roughly, on the, a little bit more than that, but we'll call it 5,000 pounds each on the Soyuz, that's the Progress cargo, that's four times a year, let me drop this. You've got the HTV from Japan, I mentioned that earlier, and that, every time that goes up, that's usually once a year, that's 10,000 pounds. You got the Cygnus, they're scheduled for around three flights per year. Well, they're doing more than that. They're doing more than 5,000 when they use the Atlas. But let's call that an average of 6,000 pounds. And so it's three for them. Then you have the Dragon spacecraft. They've been going up about an average of three times a year, and they've been doing about I think that's almost 7,000 pounds because they have the outside trunk. That's about 7,000 three flights. So what do you got there?
Wow. Progress, four per year, 5,000 each. That's 20,000 total. HTV, one per year, 10,000 pounds. Cygnus, three per year, 6,000 pounds each, that's 18,000 pounds. And Dragon, three per year, 7,000 pounds each, that's 21,000. So if I add 21, 12, 10, and 20, 20, 40, 50, 60, almost 70,000 pounds per year of hardware is brought up to the International Space Station. And that's maintaining on average, I think on the average year, there's roughly six people there, six astronauts, is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
That's for the last few years, they've had six people on board. Sometimes you'll have three for maybe a couple of weeks until the other three get back up, depending on the rotation. So, okay, based on the orbital ATK contract of 63,000 pounds total, and they were, I think, $1.8 billion. So it's, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a $2 billion a year program to restock the space station. Wow. it's not getting any, well, it actually is going to get cheaper if SpaceX could start reusing their rockets. And then the other plus will be, probably about 2019 or 2020, you'll start with Dream Chaser. They now have an official contract with NASA. Dream Chaser will be taking about 10,000 pounds. They do pretty good, too. We'll be doing good. 10,000 pounds every flight up to the space station. I'm looking forward to that one. That one comes back and lands on a runway. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I took all those numbers and added them a little bit more accurately. It comes out to 69,000 pounds per year of Progress, HTV, Sirius, and Dragon, or Cyrus. 69,000 per year for an average of six astronauts. That's 11,500 pounds per astronaut per year. I am guessing of that hardware that's delivered, the majority of it is consumables. A little bit of it is test equipment and experiments and so on. But would I be correct in assuming that probably 90% of what's delivered to the International Space Station is consumables that are maintaining the astronauts? Is that a good guess, Paul? Go ahead.
one of those progresses per year. I'm bringing up, like, mostly fuel. I mean, the thing is loaded with fuel tanks for the space station. You know, they need the hydrazine and liquid oxygen, I guess. But it's got a lot of fuel, and you know, it's like a flying gas station. So they do need that. Don't forget, they need to raise the space station about 14 miles every year. That's about the decline of the space station. I think it's something like 2 kilometers a month it drops. So let's call it, you know, 10, 12. In reality, it's probably about 16 kilometers a year, something like that, 16, 18 kilometers. So you need to get this thing up every year. And the only way we could do it nowadays is with Progress, the ATV that used to do most of the pushing is now stopped. They launched 5 of those from South America on the European Space Agency. They don't send any more of those up. They were very big spacecraft. They were good, but no more. Back to you.
When it comes to the OSIRIS-REx coming back to Earth after it collects its sample from the Bennu asteroid, it's going to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, you said at 25,000 miles an hour. And I suddenly realized how magic that number is. When the astronauts came back from the moon, they hit the Earth's atmosphere at roughly 24 or 25,000 miles an hour. We have heard for many decades escape velocity is 7 miles a second. In other words, if you could launch something with one simple acceleration at the surface of the Earth, and you got it up to 7 miles per second, you've got escape velocity. In theory, the numbers are rounded off a little bit, but in theory, the object can go away from the Earth and keep on going and never coming back, roughly 7 miles per second. If you do it in reverse, if you take something a very long distance away, and you launch it at a very low speed toward the Earth, as it gets closer and closer to the Earth's gravity is going to speed it up, and it's going to hit the Earth at escape velocity. It works exactly in reverse. So it's going to hit the Earth at roughly 7 miles per second. Let me drop. 7 miles per second, 6.999 miles per second to be exact, is 25,000 miles an hour. So something coming back from the moon, coming back from asteroid Bennu, objects that don't have any very high initial velocity, and they come into the Earth's atmosphere at a and become a meteorite. If they had no initial velocity per se, they're going to hit us at 25,000 miles an hour. So that number is not so magic. So unless you do something heroic, if you come into the Earth's atmosphere from a long distance away, you're going to come in at 25,000 miles an hour or higher. I mean, if the Earth is going around the sun counterclockwise as we view it top view from the northern hemisphere, let me drop it. And if the object happens to be in orbit around the sun in the opposite direction, let me see now. Our orbit around the sun, as I remember, is 19 miles per second. So an object hitting us because it's in orbit around the sun in the opposite direction, 19 miles a second, plus a little bit of extra as it accelerates toward the Earth. So there are meteors and meteorites that hit us at some pretty big numbers. But I'll bet almost nothing hits us at less than 25,000 miles an hour, 7 miles a second. If it was in orbit around the sun at exactly the same orbital distance as we are, and it slowly caught up with us, yes, I can see how it's going to hit us a little bit slower than 25,000. Now, even there, even if it's in orbit with us, as it gets close to the Earth, the Earth's gravity is going to accelerate it. That number 25,000, I think it's very rare that anything hits the Earth's atmosphere from a long distance away at less than 25,000 miles an hour. I bet you've seen that number and bigger numbers very frequently in your studies, Paul. W-S-2-S, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
W-2-L-I-Y, question on the subject.
Yeah, Paul first, and then we're going to go over to Joe. Go ahead, Paul.
I remember Apollo was a big topic. You know, you were going from Gemini to Apollo, and I could still see Jules Bergman. He was a reporter. One of the reporters I used to like to listen to. Back then, every station had their own reporters. Well, Bergman was terrific. He'd be with the astronauts a lot. He actually trained with them to get the feel of what it was like. And I remember him talking about the orbital speed was 5 miles a second, and to get out of here, you had to go 7 miles a second. He always said that meant when you come back, you're coming back at 25,000 miles an hour. That's why that heat shield has to be a lot better when I come back from the moon than when you're just deorbiting a Gemini spacecraft, at 17,500. So, I do remember that. And we have a lot of spacecraft that are in helical orbit. You know, you've got Stereo A, Stereo B, Kepler, a lot of spacecraft. But very few that return. We have had some called Stardust and Genesis that have come through with a capsule with a heat shield that have landed in the Utah desert, similar to what we're going to do with OSIRIS-REx. I know Joe wants to say something, but back to you, Dick, WS2S.
Yeah. 17,800 miles an hour is 5 miles a second. We all say that the in orbit around the Earth is 17,500 miles an hour, very close to 5 miles a second. But 7 miles a second is escape. And by the way, when the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 13 came back, because they were running short on oxygen and they came back as fast as they could to eliminate the amount of time in space, I think they came back a little bit higher in velocity, which means they pushed that heat shield a little bit more. When I turn it back to you, Paul, we'll be asking about that. But let's see what Joe's got to ask. To B2LYY, K2LAW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, not thinking of the cost of this, because I know the cost would be tremendous, but if you're able to bring up enough parts and pieces to build a rocket ship to Mars and have it, you know, near or at the space station, just imagine this. Will you gain anything in your speed or terminal speed you can attain by already being orbiting and going at a certain speed to begin with, and adding to that speed with a rocket built in space more than launches from the Earth? Would you really gain anything in ultimate speed? Back to you.
I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, Paul. I mean, Joe. In orbital speed around the Earth, you're moving at 17,500 miles an hour, a little bit shy of 5 miles per second. To blast away from the Earth to get into a solar orbit instead of an Earth orbit requires something close to 7 miles per second. So, space station is moving 5. You want to go to 7, you only have to add 2. Be careful. It's a square law phenomenon. To go from 5 miles a second to 7 miles a second is very different than going from 0 to 5 miles a second. It's not a linear relationship. The amount of energy required to increase your speed is a square law. So 7 miles a second squared is 49. 5 miles a second squared is 25. It's almost a 2-to-1 ratio. So the amount of energy required to get to 5 miles a second at the space station, you have to double that amount of velocity and energy to get up to 7 miles a second to escape Earth orbit and start heading toward Mars. So you choose the right time of launch as you go around the Earth. Let me drop it. As you go around the Earth in your orbit with the International Space Station, which I think is tilted at something like 50 degrees. Paul's going to correct us on that. If you choose the right time, when you're just coming over the horizon, so to speak, toward Mars, a big portion of your velocity in the direction of Mars although it's still out of plane. So you got to do a correction. You gain something. It's a lot easier to go from there to assemble the craft there, as far as the blast toward Mars is concerned. Would they do it that way? I don't know. And, Paul, I did read somewhere in the last week that our President Obama did make a pledge that he's going to fund a Mars mission at the rate that they can get there in the year 2030, which is, what, 14 years from now. He won't be in office at that time, so he doesn't have to confirm it. Let me drop it.
I hope he goes.
Okay, so he, in theory, has made a pledge for Mars. By the way, so did Johnson. After Kennedy made his pledge for the moon, and Johnson took over later on, he said he's going to go to Mars. But he didn't know what he was talking about. And is Obama really understanding all the details? Probably not.
Dick, was it Johnson who also requested the RSB-70 improvement?
Yes. Well, hold on now. Who was that, you think? Yes, it was Johnson. Johnson gave a, I think it was either a $6 or a $10 million check to Kelly Johnson, saying that, okay, you built a Mach 3 airplane, the SR-70, and so now build me a Mach 5 airplane, or is it a Mach 6? And Johnson did, Kelly Johnson did a whole bunch of back-of-the-envelope calculations and realized that he didn't have the resources to do that. He burned up $1 million worth doing the study, and whatever was left over, he mailed it back to Johnson. And so that came out much later. But the United States is making a half-hearted pledge to go to Mars. I think you've told us, Paul, that the Chinese have decided to go to Mars. The Russians are going to go at least to the moon. They're going to go to Mars. Are there 2, 3, or 4 nations on planet Earth who have made pledges saying that in the foreseeable future they're going to go to Mars and or they're going to go to moon? Run that by you, Paul. How many have made those pledges? WS2N, Space Report, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And first of all, the inclination was 51, little, almost 52, 51.6 for the space station. And it was the same for Mir as well. Let's see, to the moon, Cis Orbit, that's somewhere near the moon. Cislunar location. That would be the United States. We plan on having some kind of a space station located there. Not going down to the moon, but a space station. And we're going to bring supplies out and hope that it's all going to be put together by Orbital ATK using the same Cygnus spacecraft that are going to, that's right now restocking the space station. They plan on sending these enhanced units to lunar orbit and docking them together robotically, and then eventually sending crews out to that location. Not been funded yet, but that's the plan. Russia plans on going 2025 to the moon. India would like to have a space. They are definitely planning on a manned program, but they're probably looking at 2039 or something like that, eventually getting to the moon. But they have ambitions of going to the moon. China has a manned moon program that they would like to accomplish, and don't know when that would happen, but they just built their rocket. I talked about that earlier in the net, the Long March 5, kind of like equivalent to our heavy lift Delta 4 heavy here in the United States, or the Ariane 5 rocket. So they plan on putting their next, their third space station up with that rocket, but eventually using that rocket to send people to the moon. They have a mission called Chang 5. That will be the first orbital mission with people in it from China. They also have a planned mission to go to Mars. So China plans on going to Mars with people. But first they want to do a rover, and they have a rover 2020 similar to what we're trying to do, also called the rover 2020. So they have ambitions of sending people to Mars, but you know, right now they just want to get to Mars. They haven't accomplished that yet. Let me drop it. The only three countries so far that have successfully orbited the Red Planet is the United States, Russia, and India. They have a spacecraft orbiting called MOM, M-O-M. So those three countries, you know, have a fighting chance of doing something. What can I tell you, Dick? I just want to see what this is going to look like 5-10 years down the road. Back to you.
To be in orbit around the Earth in the International Space Station, and China is building a space station, Russia has built a couple of them, the United States has built a... Did we build more than one? Well, we had Skylab way back in 1973, roughly. You could call that a space station at the time, our first attempt at it. And Owen Garriott was one of the astronauts up there. So, lots of space stations, tremendous number of satellites around the Earth. These orbits around the moon, and to go into orbit around the moon, other than to do a ring out of the hardware, I can't think of the name that we usually give for that, but Ocean Voyage, you know what I mean. Get the bugs out of the hardware, to go in orbit around the moon, to test the hardware, I can see that. But an unmanned craft around the moon is going to get beautiful photography and beautiful spectral analysis of lunar material from space. Let me drop it. So an unmanned aircraft, an unmanned spacecraft around the moon does almost everything you can do from lunar orbit. Why put a man there? So when it comes to manned craft in orbit around the moon for some rather short period of time, it's got to be a short period of time because, I mean, we've just calculated 69,000 pounds per year are sent up to the International Space Station, where the majority of that is consumables. And to send something to lunar orbit instead of Earth orbit, let's see, Earth orbit is 200 miles up, lunar orbit is... 240,000 miles up. That's 100 times harder, 100 times greater distance, rough number. Is it 10 times or 100 times? Yeah, I think it's 100 times greater distance. You could say it's 100 times more expensive to go to the moon. So sending man there in a space station around the moon in lunar orbit and then maintaining him with consumables, and everything's 100 times more expensive. What do you get in return? Have they said, other than ringing out the hardware, what do you get to send human beings into a space station in orbit around the moon? What does that buy you, Paul? I'm being a little bit critical here. FUS2N, K2LIW, make believe you're funding it, Paul, and I'm the guy in Congress, and you're going to try to convince me how great this project is. You got it, Paul.
I'm the world's worst salesman. By the way, not to forget Joe's question, if you have put a rocket up into space, that's what Elon Musk wants to do. He wants to put a rocket up into space, you know, and then, you know, it will be totally empty by the time it's in orbit. Send another rocket, almost very similar to it, up, and then fuel that rocket, maybe, and then maybe two or three flights to completely fuel that rocket. And now you got a rocket sitting up there that's really loaded with fuel, and now you could send this all the way to Mars instead of the 6 or 8 month time frame. You can get it down to 4 months, so you won't don't have to spend that much time in space getting there. So that's his goal. That's called the ITS, the Interplanetary Transport Space System that he wants to develop. And he's 10 years out, he plans on having this thing built. Again, I want to come back in 10 years from now and see what's going on. As far as doing all these things, we like missions. Let me drop it. WH Roy, what was the question for that, Paul? Okay, I'll give Dick a quick answer on the funding. We like missions like Cassini, Galileo, which went around Jupiter, New Horizons. We love the two Voyager missions. I believe that none of these would have taken place if it wasn't for the manned space program. The general public are not sitting here on ham radios listening to these technical conversations, but they're reading the paper or tablets now, whatever, and watching TV, and they don't see anything about the space program. You set people up, and their eyes are going to open. Their wallets might even open to support this program, especially if it's competitive against the Russians or China or India or some other country. And that's what gets the ball rolling. And next thing you know, you're flying to the moon. But at the same time, you're developing the capability of sending spacecraft to Mars to investigate the planets, maybe an orbital flight around Europa in the future. And that there's even plans on going to Uranus. They'd like to orbit that planet. They investigate that planet with its 27 moons. Those things wouldn't happen if it wasn't for the manned space program, because that creates money momentum. Should I go to Congress and tell them, Dick? Back to you.
Okay. So it puts a whole lot of people to work, money momentum. You develop a lot of hardware. But now you're spending a substantial percentage of the United States gross national product. And do we get enough in return is an interesting question. By the way, I made a math error before. International Space Station, I'm going to round off the numbers, 240 miles up above our surface. Moon is 240,000 miles. So the moon is 1,000 times further away from the surface of the Earth than the International Space Station. Boy, that's got to make it expensive. For every pound of hardware you put into Earth orbit, the number used to be $1,000 a pound. And if you're now going to go a distance 1,000 times further away, every pound of hardware you put into lunar orbit is extremely expensive. I think Joe's got some further questions. W-H-R-Y-Y, K-2-I-W-I, Joe.
Okay, thank you, Nick. All right, say they are able to do what Elon Musk said, what Paul mentioned about assembling a rocket, ultimately in space, next to the space station or somewhere in their vicinity. You're able to put the thing together, fuel this thing, and say you start accelerating. You said it takes a lot more to accelerate from the space station point of view, accelerating out the two to get up to, say, 25,000 miles an hour to go from one speed to another. But doesn't it cost you a lot of fuel to begin with, leaving the Earth, if you want to leave and keep on going at 7 miles per second? And ultimately, if they did that from space, here's the first question. How fast do you think they could achieve in an ultimate speed? That's question number one. And say you point yourself in the right trajectory to be aimed at a point where Mars is going to be when you think you want to arrive in the vicinity of Mars. How fast can you go before you can't deaccelerate from Mars? That'd be the second question in this discussion.
Look at New Horizon, how fast it got from here to the moon.
To partially answer your question, Joe, I'm going to describe the Holman maneuver. Let's assume now that you and I have got the International Space Station at 240 miles above the surface of the Earth. And for some reason, we want it to be 340 miles above the surface of the Earth. How would you do that? And the least energy required to go into that larger orbit. The reason I'm using this is because when you go from Earth to Mars, your you're in orbit around the Earth, around the Sun. The Earth is 93 million miles from the Earth, from the Sun. Mars is, I don't know the exact number. I'm going to guess it's, in fact,
1.6 AU.
There you go. So 1.6 times 93 million miles, roughly 150 million miles. So Mars is 150 million miles. So you want to go from an orbit around the Sun at the Earth, 93 million miles. You want to go to an orbit around the Sun that equals the Mars orbit, 150 million miles. You're trying to gain almost 60 million miles of extra altitude from the Sun. Whenever you leave the Earth, you think you're just flying through free space. You're another object around the Sun. You're an object around the Sun when you're away from the Earth. And that's what really determines your trajectory. And so the Holman maneuver, in the case of the simple case of the International Space Station, it's at 240 miles, and I want to go to 340 miles. I do a prograde burn. Let me drop. I'm going around the Earth from west to east in the International Space Station. I aim my rocket to the west to speed up. So I speed up 17,500 miles an hour, some number of miles an hour. And I do that as a quick burn. And on the opposite side of my orbit, on the other side of the Earth when I get there, I will now be at the higher altitude. If I do the burn just right, I now have an elliptical orbit. I always come back to the same spot. So I'm at 240 miles where I make the burn. I'll be at 340 miles on the opposite side of the Earth. And if I did nothing, I would drift back on this side of the Earth again, back to 240. I just made my orbit elliptical by making the burn. When I'm on the far side, and I'm at 340 miles above the surface of the Earth, I do a second burn that circularizes the orbit. That double burn in order to go to a higher orbit is called a Holman maneuver. You're going to do something slightly similar to that in order to get to Mars and to get back home again. So there are very desirable times in the Earth-Mars orbital mechanics. There's very desirable times when you make the blast from Earth toward Mars. The most desirable time would be you're going to do the burn near Earth, leaving Earth orbit. Let me drop. So that when the Earth is on the opposite side of the Sun, that's the other, that's the perigee of your orbit, you want the, apogee. Apogee is not the right word. Apocynthian is not the right word. Aphelion. Right now, we're at 93 million miles from the Sun. We're going to do a burn in the direction that the Earth is moving around the Sun. You do a burn so that at the opposite side of the Earth, you're not going to be at 93 million, you're going to be at 150 million. And if you do the timing just right, that's the minimum energy required for you to get to the higher orbit where Mars is. And if the timing is just right, Mars is there when you get there. I wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. From HRYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's starting to make some sense, but ultimately, I guess the question I'm asking is, would it take you more fuel or less fuel to leave the Earth directly to go to Mars, or to leave from a, you know, orbit around the Earth, going in the same general direction once you put yourself up at the right orbit?
Okay. I'm guessing that the speed you're going to leave Earth orbit going toward Mars is something close to 7 miles a second, something close to 25,000 miles an hour. When you're in orbit around the Sun, that's not right. Earth is moving 17 miles per second in orbit around the Sun. In all cases, you never go straight there. Good common sense leads you to believe the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. You think if you go straight to Mars, it's the minimum time, I'll give you that. It is far from the minimum energy. The minimum energy is doing the burn so that your orbit around the Sun starts off at 93 million miles from the Sun, and you do a burn so that you speed up And now on the opposite side of the sun, when you get there, you're at 150 million miles from the sun, because that's the altitude of Mars away from the sun. So that's the minimum energy requirement, and that's going to take you exactly half a year to get there, per se. So it's going to take you 6 months to get to Mars in the minimum burn that I can see. That sounds... I've been hearing numbers much bigger than that, Paul, so I'm a little bit confused. Elon Musk has talked about various timing. What kind of timing has he been talking about to get to Mars? WS2N, K2RIW?
He says he can get it down to 4 months instead of the typical 6 or 8 months is the average time now. Which is doable, but, you know, like Joe says, you're going to need a big rocket that's empty to do that. You fill it up, you get it to orbit, and you know, use all the fuel to get this massive rocket into orbit. Then bring up about 3 or 4 other rockets, you know, about the same size, and fuel that rocket. After that's done, you can now send it off to Mars. And to do it directly from Earth, yes, you can, but he said you would need a rocket instead of, you know, 300 feet high, you would need a rocket like 1,000 feet high to, you know, to do it in one shot. So, you know, he wants to do this in, you know, say 4 rockets to set himself up. Now you've got a fully loaded rocket and you can send, you know, 100 people to Mars in one shot in 4 months instead of 6 or 8 months. So that's his theory, and you know, it could work. You could take, like, for instance, you took the 1,000 pound little over, it was about 1,800 pounds when it started, the New Horizons spacecraft. They put it on top of the Atlas rocket with 5 boosters. Let me drop it. 5 boosters when it left Cape Canaveral. And it's the fastest thing that has ever left Earth, because it was basically a light payload. And because it wasn't, you know, it didn't weigh 5 tons or 20, you know, 10 tons. It only weighed roughly 2,000, it's close to 2,000 pounds. When it passed the moon, the equivalent of the moon orbit, it took our astronauts roughly 3 and a half days to get to the moon. This thing passed the moon orbit in 9 hours. It was out to Mars in no time compared to, you know, the flights that we've sent out there, the rovers and all. It made it to Pluto in 10 years, nine and a half years, instead of what would have taken 12 or 13 or 14 years if it was a heavier spacecraft or a rocket with less fuel.
Yeah, this is the last I'm going to say on this one, though, Joe. I've only got the whole, story, but minimum energy required to get to the Mars orbit is the amount of energy that speeds you up from a 93-mile, let me call it perigee, helium. So, and it takes you 6 months to get to that point. And when you get there, you just coast up to the Mars altitude away from the sun, and you arrive at a nice slow speed. You go there directly, you're going to start off at a much higher velocity, and we got to sign off. Bye-bye for now. See you guys later. K2RIW clear. KC2WGB. Squeeze in some final words there, John.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
Sam, I tried to leave early.
Carrier, or his finals burned out, so I'm going to go back there, but I'll have